Sim, get going and make it quick. Madge Webber, if you raise a hand, I'll put you in the stocks, and your husband won't stop me either. And not a word from you, Caris Wooler, please. You may complain to your father about me if you wish. Before John had finished speaking, Sim jerked hard on the rope. Gwenda was tipped forward and stuck a foot out in front of her to keep from falling to the ground. Then, somehow, she was moving along, stumbling and half-running down the street. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Caris alongside her. Then John Constable seized Caris by the arm. She turned to protest to him, and a moment later she disappeared from Gwenda's sight. Sim walked quickly down the muddy main street, hauling on the rope, keeping Gwenda just off balance. As they approached the bridge, she began to feel desperate. She tried jerking back on the rope, but he responded with an extra strong heave that threw her down in the mud. Her arms were still pinioned, so she could not use her hands to protect herself, and she fell flat, bruising her chest, her face squelching into the ooze. She struggled to her feet, giving up all resistance. Roped like an animal, hurt, frightened, and covered in filthy mud, she staggered after her new owner, across the bridge and along the road that led into the forest. Sim Chapman led Gwenda through the suburb of Newtown to the crossroads known as Gallows Cross, where criminals were hanged. There he took the road south, towards Wigley. He tied her rope to his wrist so that she could not break away, even when his attention wandered. Her dog, Skip, followed them, but Sim threw stones at him, and after one hit him full on the nose, he retreated with his tail between his legs. After several miles, as the sun began to set, Sim turned into the forest. Gwenda had seen no feature beside the road to mark the spot, but Sim seemed to have chosen carefully, for a few hundred paces into the trees, they came upon a pathway. Looking down, Gwenda could see the neat impressions of dozens of small hooves in the earth, and she realized it was a deer path. It would lead to water, she guessed. Sure enough, they came to a little brook, the vegetation on either side trodden into mud. Sim knelt beside the stream, filled his cupped hands with clear water, and drank. Then he moved the rope so that it was around her neck, freeing her hands, and motioned her to the water. She washed her hands in the stream, then drank thirstily. "Wash your face," he ordered. "You're ugly enough by nature." She did as she was told, wondering wearily why he cared how she looked. The path continued on the farther side of the drinking hole. They walked on. Gwenda was a strong girl, capable of walking all day, but she was defeated and miserable and scared, and that made her feel exhausted. Whatever fate awaited her at their destination, it was probably worse than this, but all the same she yearned to get there so that she could sit down. Darkness was falling. The deer path wound through trees for a mile, then petered out at the foot of a hill. Sim stopped beside a particularly massive oak tree and gave a low whistle. A few moments later, a figure materialized out of the half-lit woodland and said,
"All right, Sim."
"All right, Jed."
"What you got there, a fruit tart?" "You shall have a slice, Jed, same as the others, so long as you've got sixpence."
Gwenda realized what Sim had planned. He was going to prostitute her. The realization hit her like a blow, and she staggered and fell to her knees.
"Sixpence, eh?"
Jed's voice seemed to come from far away, but all the same she could hear the excitement in his voice.
"How old is she?" "Her father claimed she was 16, but I'd guess nearer to 18.
Sim jerked on the rope.
"Stand up, you lazy cow! We're not there yet."
Gwenda got to her feet. That's why he wanted me to wash my face, she thought, and for some reason the realization made her cry. She wept hopelessly as she stumbled along in Sim's footsteps until they came to a clearing with a fire in the middle. Through her tears, she perceived 15 or 20 people lying around the edge of the clearing, most of them wrapped in blankets or cloaks. Almost all those watching her in the firelight were male, but she caught sight of a white female face, hard in expression but smooth-chinned, that stared at her briefly, then disappeared back into a bundle of ragged bedding. An upturned wine barrel and a scattering of wooden cups testified to a drunken party. Gwenda realized that Sim had brought her to a den of outlaws. She groaned. How many of them would she be forced to submit to? As soon as she asked herself the question, she knew the answer. All of them. Sim dragged her across the clearing to a man who was sitting upright, his back against a tree.
"All right, Tem," said Sim.
Gwenda knew instantly who the man must be. The most famous outlaw in the county, he was called Tam Hiding. He had a handsome face, though it was reddened by drink. People said he was noble-born, but they always said that about famous outlaws. Looking at him, Gwenda was surprised by his youth. He was in his mid-twenties, but then to kill an outlaw was no crime, so in all probability few lived to be old. Tam said,
"All right, Sim. I traded Owen's cow for a girl."
"Well done."
Tam's speech was only slightly slurred.
"We're going to charge the boys sixpence, but of course you can have a free go. I expect you'd like to be first."
Tam peered at her with bloodshot eyes. Perhaps it was wishful thinking, but she imagined she saw a hint of pity in his look. He said,
"No thanks, Sim. You go ahead and let the boys have a good time, though you might want to leave it until tomorrow. We got a barrel of good wine from a pair of monks who were taking it to Kingsbridge, and most of the lads are dead drunk now."
Gwenda's heart leaped with hope. Perhaps her torture would be postponed.
"I'll have to consult Alwyn," Sim said doubtfully. "Thanks, Tam."
He turned away, pulling Gwenda behind him. A few yards away, a broad-shouldered man was struggling to his feet. Sim said,
"All right, Alwyn."
The phrase seemed to serve the outlaws as a greeting and a recognition code. Alwyn was at the bad-tempered phase of drunkenness.
"What have you got?"
"A fresh young girl."
Alwyn took Gwenda's chin in his hand, gripping unnecessarily hard, and turned her face to the firelight. She was forced to look into his eyes. He was young, like Tam Hiding, but with the same unhealthy air of dissipation. His breath smelled of drink.
"By Christ, you picked an ugly one," he said.
For once Gwenda was happy to be thought ugly. Perhaps Alwyn would not want to do anything to her.
"I took what I could get," Sim said testily. "If the man had a beautiful daughter, he wouldn't sell her for a cow, would he? He'd marry her to the son of a rich wool merchant instead."
The thought of her father made Gwenda angry. He must have known or suspected that this would happen. How could he do it to her?
All right, it doesn't matter," Alwyn said to Sim. "With only two women in the group, most of the lads are desperate."
"Tam said we should wait until tomorrow, because they're all too drunk tonight. But it's up to you."
"Tam's right. Half of them are asleep already."
Gwenda's fear retreated a little. Anything could happen overnight.
"Good," Sim said. "I'm dog tired anyway."
He looked at Gwenda.
"Lie down, you."
He never called her by her name. She lay down, and he used the rope to tie her feet together and her hands behind her back. Then he and Alwyn lay down either side of her. In a few moments both men were asleep. Gwenda was exhausted, but she had no thought of sleep. With her arms behind her back, every position was painful. She tried to move her wrists within the rope, but Sim had pulled it tight and knotted it well. All she achieved was to break her skin so that the rope burned her flesh. Despair turned to helpless rage, and she pictured herself taking revenge on her captors, lashing them all with a whip as they cowered in front of her. It was a pointless fantasy. She turned her mind to practical means of escape. First, she would have to make them untie her. That done, she would have to get away. Ideally, she would somehow ensure they could not follow her and recapture her. It seemed impossible. Chapter 12 Gwenda was cold when she woke up. It was midsummer, but the weather was cool, and she had no covering but her light dress. The sky was turning from black to grey. She looked around the clearing in the faint light. No one was moving. She needed to pee. She thought of doing it there and soaking her dress. If she made herself disgusting, so much the better. Almost as soon as the thought occurred to her, she dismissed it. That would be giving up. She was not giving up. But what was she going to do? Alwyn was sleeping beside her, with his long dagger in its sheath, still attached to his belt, and that gave her the glimmer of an idea. She was not sure she had the nerve to carry out the plan that was forming in her mind, but she refused to think about how scared she was. She just had to do it. Although her ankles were tied together, she could move her legs. She kicked Alwyn. At first, he did not seem to feel it. She kicked him again, and he moved. The third time, he sat upright.
"Was that you?" he said blearily.
"I have to pee," she said.
"Not in the clearing. It's one of Tam's rules. Go 20 paces for a piss, 50 for a shit."
"So, even outlaws live by rules."
He stared uncomprehendingly at her. The irony escaped him. He was not a clever man, she realized. That was helpful. But he was strong and mean. She would have to be very cautious. She said,
"I can't go anywhere tied up."
Grumbling, he undid the rope around her ankles. The first part of her plan had worked. Now she was even more frightened. She struggled to her feet. All the muscles of her legs ached from a night of constriction. She took a step, stumbled, and fell down again.
"It's so hard with my hands tied," she said.
He ignored that. The second part of her plan had not worked. She would have to keep trying. She got up again and walked into the trees with Alwyn following her. He was counting paces on his fingers. The first time he got to 10, he started again. The second time, he said, "Far enough." She looked at him helplessly.
"I can't lift my dress," she said.
Would he fall for this? He stared dumbly at her. She could almost hear his brain working, rumbling like the gears of a watermill. He could lift her dress while she peed, but that was the kind of thing a mother did for a toddler, and he would find it humiliating. Alternatively, he could untie her hands. With hands and feet free, she might make a run for it. But she was small, weary, and cramped. There was no way she could outrun a man with long, muscular legs. He must be thinking that the risk was not serious. He untied the rope around her wrists. She looked away from him so that he would not see her look of triumph. She rubbed her forearms to restore the circulation. She wanted to poke his eyeballs out with her thumbs, but instead she smiled as sweetly as she could and said,
"Thank you,"
as if he had performed an act of kindness. He said nothing but stood watching her, waiting. She expected him to look away when she hitched up the skirt of her dress and squatted, but he only stared more intensely. She held his gaze, unwilling to act ashamed while she did what was natural. His mouth opened slightly, and she could tell he was breathing harder. Now came the hardest part. She stood up slowly, letting him get a good look before she dropped her dress. He licked his lips, and she knew she had him. She went closer and stood in front of him.
"Will you be my protector?" she said,
using a little girl voice that did not come naturally to her. He showed no sign of suspicion. He did not speak, but grasped her breast in his rough hand and squeezed. She gasped with pain.
"Not so hard!"
She took his hand in hers.
"Be more gentle."
She moved his hand against her breast, rubbing the nipples so that it stood up.
"It's nicer if you're gentle."
He grunted, but continued to rub softly. Then he took the neckline of her dress in his left hand and drew his dagger. The knife was a foot long with a point, and the blade gleamed with recent sharpening. He obviously intended to cut her dress off. That would not do. It would leave her naked. She took his wrist in a light grip, restraining him momentarily.
"You don't need the knife," she said. "Look."
She stepped back, undid her belt, and with a quick movement pulled the dress off over her head. It was her only garment. She stretched it out on the ground, then lay on it. She tried to smile at him. She felt sure the result was a horrible grimace. Then she parted her legs. He hesitated only for a moment. Keeping the knife in his right hand, he pushed down his underdrawers and knelt between her thighs. He pointed the dagger at her face and said, "Any trouble, and I'll slice your cheek open."
"You won't need to do that," she said.
She was trying desperately to think what words such a man would like to hear from a woman.
"My big, strong protector," she said.
He showed no reaction to that. He lay over her, thrusting blindly.
"Not so fast,"
she said, gritting her teeth against the pain of his clumsy stabs. She reached between her legs and guided him inside, throwing her legs up to make the entrance easier. He reared over her, taking his weight on his arms. He put the dagger on the grass beside her head, covering the hilt with his right hand. He groaned as he moved inside her. She moved with him, keeping up the pretense of willingness, watching his face, forcing herself not to glance sideways at the dagger, waiting for her moment. She was both scared and disgusted, but a small part of her mind remained calm and calculating. He closed his eyes and lifted his head like an animal scenting the breeze. His arms were straight, holding him up. She risked a look at the knife. He had moved his hand slightly, so that it only partly covered the hilt. She could grab it now, but how fast would he react? She looked at his face again. His mouth was twisted in a rictus of concentration. He thrust faster, and she matched his motion. To her dismay, she felt a glow spread through her loins. She was appalled at herself. The man was a murdering outlaw, little better than a beast, and he was planning to prostitute her for sixpence a time. She was doing this to save her life, not for enjoyment. Yet there was a gush of moisture inside her, and he thrust faster. She sensed that his moment of climax was near. It was now or never. He gave a groan that sounded like surrender, and she moved. She snatched the knife from under his hand. There was no change in the expression of ecstasy on his face. He had not noticed her movement. Terrified that he would see what she was doing and stop her at the last moment, she did not hesitate but jabbed upwards, jerking her shoulders up from the lying position as she did so. He sensed her movement and opened his eyes. Shock and fear showed on his face. Stabbing wildly, she stuck the knife into his throat just below the jaw. She cursed, knowing she had missed the most vulnerable parts of the neck, the breathing pipe and the jugular vein. He roared with pain and rage, but he was not incapacitated, and she knew she was as close to death as she had ever been. She moved instinctively, without forethought. Using her left arm, she struck at the inside of his elbow. He could not prevent the bending of his arm, and involuntarily he slumped. She pushed harder at the foot-long dagger, and his weight dragged him down onto the blade. As the knife entered his head from below, blood gushed from his open mouth, falling on her face, and she jerked her head aside reflexively. But she kept pushing on the knife. The blade met resistance for a moment, then slipped through until his eyeball seemed to explode, and she saw the point emerge from the eye socket in a spray of blood and brains. He slumped on top of her, dead, or nearly so. His weight knocked the breath out of her. It was like being stuck under a fallen tree. For a moment she was helpless to move. To her horror, she felt him ejaculate inside her. She was filled with superstitious terror. He was more frightening like this than when he had threatened her with a knife. Panicking, she wriggled out from under him. She scrambled to her feet shakily, breathing hard. She had his blood on her breasts and his seed on her thighs. She glanced fearfully towards the outlaw's camp. Had anyone been awake to hear Alwyn's shout? If they had all been asleep, had the sound wakened any of them? Trembling, She pulled her dress over her head and buckled her belt. She had her wallet and her own small knife, mainly used for eating. She hardly dared take her eyes off Alwyn. She had a dreadful feeling he might still be alive. She knew she should finish him off, but she could not bring herself to do it. A sound from the direction of the clearing startled her. She needed to get away fast. She looked around, getting her bearings, then headed in the direction of the road. There was a sentry near the big oak tree, she recalled, with a sudden start of fear. She walked softly through the woods, careful to make no sound as she approached the tree. Then she saw the sentry. Jed, his name was, fast asleep on the ground. She tiptoed past him. It took all her willpower not to break into a mad run, but he did not stir. She found the deer path and followed it to the brook. It seemed there was no one on her tail. She washed the blood off her face and chest, then splashed cold water on her private parts. She drank deeply, knowing she had a long walk ahead. Feeling slightly less frantic, she continued along the deer path. As she walked, she listened. How soon would the outlaws find Alwyn? She had not even tried to conceal the body. When they figured out what had happened, they would surely come after her, for they had given a cow for her, and that was worth 12 shillings, half a year's pay for a laborer such as her father. She reached the road. For a woman traveling alone, the open road was almost as hazardous as a forest track. Tam Hiding's group were not the only outlaws, and there were plenty of other men, squires, peasant boys, bands of men-at-arms, who might take advantage of a defenseless woman. But her first priority was to get away from Sim Chapman and his cronies, so speed was paramount. Which direction should she take? If she went home to Wigley, Sim might follow her there and claim her back, and there was no telling how her father would deal with that. She needed friends she could trust. Caris would help her. She set off for Kingsbridge. It was a clear day, but the road was muddy from many days of rain, and walking was that much more difficult. After a while, she reached the top of a hill. Looking back, she could see along the road for about a mile. At the far limit of her vision, she saw a lone figure striding along. He wore a yellow tunic. Sim Chapman. She broke into a run. The case against Crazy Nell was heard in the north transept of the cathedral on Saturday at noon. Bishop Richard presided over the ecclesiastical court, with Prior Anthony on his right, and on his left, his personal assistant, Archdeacon Lloyd, a dour, black-haired priest who was said to do all the actual work of the bishopric. There was a big crowd of townspeople. A heresy trial was good entertainment, and Kingsbridge had not seen one for years. Many craftsmen and labourers finished work at midday on Saturdays. Outside, the fleece fair was coming to an end, tradespeople dismantling their stalls and packing up their unsold goods, buyers preparing for the journey home, or arranging to consign their purchases by raft downriver to the seaport of Melcombe. Waiting for the trial to begin, Caris thought gloomily of Gwenda. What was she doing now? Sim Chapman would force her to have sex with him for sure, but that might not be the worst thing to happen to her. What else would she have to do as his slave? Caris had no doubt Gwenda would try to escape, but would she succeed? And if she failed, how would Sim punish her? Caris realized she might never find out. It had been a strange week. Buonaventura Caroli had not changed his mind. The Florentine buyers would not return to Kingsbridge, at least until the priory improved facilities for the fleece fair. Caris's father and the other leading wool merchants had spent half the week shut up with Earl Rowland. Merthin continued in a strange mood, withdrawn and gloomy. And it was raining again. Nell was dragged into church by John Constable and Friar Murdo. Her only garment was a sleeveless surcoat, fastened at the front, but revealing her bony shoulders. She had no hat or shoes. She struggled feebly in the men's grasp, shouting imprecations. When they got her quietened down, A series of townspeople came forward to attest that they had heard her call upon the devil. They were telling the truth. Nell threatened people with the devil all the time, for refusing to give her a handout, for standing in her way on the street, for wearing a good coat, or for no reason at all. Each witness related some misfortune that had followed the curse. A goldsmith's wife had lost a valuable brooch, and innkeeper's chickens had all died. A widow developed a painful boil on her bottom, a complaint that caused laughter, but also carried conviction, for witches were known to have a malicious sense of humor. While this was going on, Merthyn appeared beside Carys. "This is so stupid," Carys said to him indignantly. 10 times the number of witnesses could come forward to say that Nell cursed them and nothing bad ensued." Merthyn shrugged. "People just believe what they want to believe. Ordinary people, perhaps. But the bishop and the prior should know better. They are educated." "I've got something to tell you," Merthyn said. Carys perked up. Perhaps she was about to learn the reason for his bad mood. She had been looking at him sidelong, but now she turned and saw that he had a huge bruise on the left side of his face. "What happened to you?" The crowd roared with laughter at some interjection of Nell's, and Archdeacon Lloyd had to call repeatedly for quiet. When Merthyn could be heard again, he said, "Not here. Can we go somewhere quiet?" She almost turned to leave with him, but something stopped her. All week long he had bewildered and wounded her by his coldness. Now, at last, he had decided he was ready to say what was on his mind, and she was expected to jump at his command. Why should he set the timetable? He had made her wait 5 days. Why should she not make him wait an hour or so? "No," she said, "not now." He looked surprised. "Why not?" "Because it doesn't suit my convenience," she said. "Now let me listen." As she turned from him, she saw a hurt look cross his face, and straightway she wished she had not been so cold. But it was too late, and she was not going to apologize. The witnesses had finished. Bishop Richard said, "Woman, do you say that the devil rules the earth?" Carys was outraged. Heretics worshipped Satan because they believed he had jurisdiction over the earth, and God only ruled heaven. Crazy Nell could not even understand such a sophisticated credo. It was disgraceful that Richard was going along with Friar Murdo's ridiculous accusation. Nell shouted back, "You can shove your prick up your arse!" The crowd laughed, delighted by this coarse insult to the bishop. Richard said, "If that's her defense." Archdeacon Lloyd intervened. "Someone should speak on her behalf," he said. He spoke respectfully, but he seemed comfortable correcting his superior. No doubt the lazy Richard relied on Lloyd to remind him of the rules. Richard looked around the transept. "Who will speak for Nell?" he called out. Carys waited, but no one volunteered. She could not allow this to happen. Someone must point out how irrational this whole procedure was. When no one else spoke, Carys stood up. "Nell is mad," she said. Everyone looked around, wondering who was foolish enough to side with Nell. There was a murmur of recognition. Most people knew Carys, but no great sense of surprise, for she had a reputation for doing the unexpected. Prior Anthony leaned over and said something in the bishop's ear. Richard said, "Carys, the daughter of Edmund Wooler, tells us that the accused woman is mad. We had reached that conclusion without her assistance." Carys was goaded by his cool sarcasm. "Nell has no idea what she is saying. She calls upon the devil, the saints, the moon and the stars. It has no more meaning than the barking of a dog. You might as well hang a horse for neighing at the king." She could not keep the note of scorn from her voice, though she knew it was unwise to let your contempt show when addressing the nobility. Some of the crowd murmured agreement. They liked a spirited argument. Richard said, but you have heard people testify to the damage done by her curses.
I lost a penny yesterday, Caris rejoined. I boiled an egg, and it was bad. My father lay awake all night coughing, but no one cursed us. Bad things just happen.
There was much head-shaking at this. Most people believed there was some malign influence behind every misfortune, great or small. Caris had lost the support of the crowd. Prior Antony, her uncle, knew her views and had argued with her before. Now he leaned forward and said, "Surely you don't believe that God is responsible for illness and misfortune and loss?"
"No. Who, then?"
Caris imitated Antony's prissy tone. "Surely you don't believe that every misfortune in life is the responsibility of either God or Crazy Nell?" Archdeacon Lloyd said sharply, "Speak respectfully to the prior." He did not realize Antony was Caris's uncle. The townspeople laughed. They knew the prim prior and his independent-minded niece. Caris finished. "I believe Nell is harmless. Mad, yes, but harmless." Suddenly Friar Murdo was on his feet.
"My Lord Bishop, men of Kingsbridge, friends," he said in his sonorous voice, "the evil one is everywhere among us, tempting us to sin, to lying, greed of food, drunkenness with wine, puffed-up pride and fleshly lust."
The crowd liked this. Murdo's descriptions of sin called to the imagination delightful scenes of indulgence that were sanctified by his brimstone disapproval.
"But he cannot go unobserved," Murdo went on, his voice rising with excitement. "As the horse presses his hoofprints into the mud, as the kitchen mouse makes dainty tracks across the butter, as the lecher deposits his vile seed to grow in the womb of the deceived maid, so the devil must leave his mark."
They shouted their approval. They knew what he meant, and so did Caris.
"The servants of the evil one may be known by the mark he leaves upon them, for he sucks their hot blood as a child sucks the sweet milk from its mother's swollen breasts. And like the child, he needs a teat from which to suck. A third nipple."
He had the audience rapt, Caris observed. He began each sentence in a low, quiet voice, then built it up, piling one emotive phrase on another to his climax. And the crowd responded eagerly, listening in silence while he spoke, then shouting their approval at the end.
"This mark is dark in color, ridged like a nipple, and rises from the clear skin around it. It may be on any part of the body. Sometimes it lies in the soft valley between a woman's breasts, the unnatural manifestation cruelly mimicking the natural. But the devil best likes it to be in the secret places of the body, in the groin, on the private parts, especially—"
Bishop Richard said loudly, "Thank you, Friar Murdo. You need go no farther. You are demanding that the woman's body be examined for the devil's mark."
"Yes, my Lord Bishop, for—"
"All right. No need for further argument. Your point is well made." He looked around. "Is Mother Cecilia close by?" The prioress was sitting on a bench on one side of the court, with Sister Juliana and some of the senior nuns. Crazy Nell's naked body could not be examined by men, so women would have to do it in private and report back. The nuns were the obvious choice. Caris did not envy them their task. Most townspeople washed their hands and faces every day, and the smellier parts of their bodies once a week. All overbathing was, at best, a twice-a-year ritual, necessary though dangerous to the health. However, Crazy Nell never seemed to wash at all. Her face was grimy, her hands were filthy, and she smelled like a dunghill. Cecilia stood up. Richard said, "Please, take this woman to a private room, remove her clothing, examine her body carefully, and come back to report faithfully what you find." The nuns got up immediately and approached Nell. Cecilia spoke soothingly to the mad woman and took her gently by the arm. But Nell was not fooled. She twisted away, throwing her arms into the air. At that point, Friar Murdo shouted, "I see it! I see it!" Four of the nuns managed to hold Nell still. The friar said, "No need to take off her clothes. Just look under her right arm." As Nell started to wriggle again, he strode over to her and lifted her arm himself, holding it high above her head. "There," he said, pointing into her armpit. The crowd surged forward. "I see it," someone shouted, and others repeated the cry. Caris could see nothing other than normal armpit hair, and she was unwilling to commit the indignity of peering. She had no doubt that Nell had some kind of blemish or growth there. Lots of people had marks on their skin, especially the elderly. Archdeacon Lloyd called for order, and John Constable beat the crowd back with a stick. When at last the church was quiet, Richard stood up. "Crazy Nell of Kingsbridge, I find you guilty of heresy," he said. "You shall now be tied to the back of a cart and whipped through the town, then taken to the place known as Gallows Cross, where you shall be hanged by the neck until you die." The crowd cheered. Caris turned away in disgust. With justice like this, no woman was safe. Her eye lit on Merthyn, waiting patiently for her. "All right," she said bad-temperedly. "What is it?" "It stopped raining," he said. "Come down to the river." The priory had a string of ponies for the senior monks and nuns to use when travelling, plus some cart horses for transporting goods. These were kept, along with the mounts of prosperous visitors, in a run of stone stables at the south end of the cathedral close. The nearby kitchen garden was manured with the straw from the stalls. Ralph was in the stable yard with the rest of Earl Roland's entourage. Their horses were saddled, ready to begin the 2-day journey back to Roland's residence at Earl's Castle, near Shiring. They were waiting only for the Earl. Ralph was holding his horse, a bay called Griff, and talking to his parents. "I don't know why Stephen was made Lord of Wigley while I got nothing," he said. "We're the same age, and he's no better than I am at riding or jousting or fencing." Every time they met, Sir Gerald asked the same hopeful questions, and Ralph had to give him the same inadequate answers. Ralph could have borne his disappointment more easily had it not been for his father's pathetic eagerness to see him elevated. Griff was a young horse. He was a hunter. A mere squire did not merit a costly war horse. But Ralph liked him. He responded gratifyingly well when Ralph urged him on in the hunt. Griff was excited by all the activity in the yard, and impatient to get going. Ralph murmured in his ear, "Quiet, my lovely lad. You shall stretch your legs later." The horse calmed down at the sound of his voice. "Be constantly on the alert for ways to please the Earl," Sir Gerald said. "Then he will remember you when there is a post to be filled." That was all very well, Ralph thought, but the real opportunities came only in battle. However, war might be a little nearer today than it had been a week ago. Ralph had not been in on the meetings between the Earl and the wool merchants, but he gathered that the merchants were willing to lend money to King Edward. They wanted the king to take some decisive action against France, in retaliation for French attacks on the south coast ports. Meanwhile, Ralph longed for some way to distinguish himself and begin to win back the honour the family had lost 10 years ago, not just for his father, but for his own pride. Griff stamped and tossed his head. To calm him, Ralph began to walk him up and down, and his father walked with him. His mother stood apart. She was upset about his broken nose. With father he walked past Lady Philippa, who was holding the bridle of a spirited courser with a firm hand, while she talked to her husband, Lord William. She wore close-fitting clothes, which were suitable for a long ride, but also emphasized her full bosom and long legs. Ralph was always on the lookout for excuses to talk to her, but it did him no good. He was just one of her father-in-law's followers, and she never spoke to him unless she had to. As Ralph watched, she smiled at her husband and tapped him on the chest with the back of her hand, in a gesture of mock reprimand. Ralph was filled with resentment. Why should it not be him with whom she was sharing such a moment of private amusement? No doubt she would, if he were lord of 40 villages, as William was. Ralph felt that his life was all aspiration. When would he actually achieve something? He and his father walked the length of the yard, then turned and came back. He saw a one-armed monk come out of the kitchen and cross the yard, and was struck by how familiar the man looked. A moment later, he remembered how he knew the face. This was Thomas Langley, the knight who had killed the 2 men-at-arms in the forest 10 years ago. Ralph had not seen the man since that day, but his brother Merthin had, for the knight-become monk was now responsible for supervising repairs to the priory buildings. Thomas wore a drab robe instead of the fine clothes of a knight, and had his head shaved in the monkish tonsure. He was heavier around the waist, but still carried himself like a fighting man. As Thomas walked past, Ralph said casually to Lord William, "There he goes, the mystery monk." William said sharply, "What do you mean?" "Brother Thomas, he used to be a knight, and no one knows why he joined the monastery." "What the devil do you know of him?" William's tone showed anger, although Ralph had said nothing offensive. Perhaps he was in a bad mood, despite the affectionate smiles of his beautiful wife. Ralph wished he had not begun the conversation. "I remember the day he came to Kingsbridge," he said. He hesitated, remembering the oath the children had sworn that afternoon. Because of that, and because of William's inexplicable annoyance, Ralph did not tell the whole story. "He staggered into town bleeding from a sword wound," he went on. "A boy remembers such things." Philippa said, "How curious." She looked at her husband. "Do you know what Brother Thomas's story is?"
"Certainly not," William snapped. "How would I know a thing like that?"
She shrugged and turned away. Ralph walked on, glad to get away. "Lord William was lying," he said to his father in a low voice. "I wonder why." "Don't ask any more questions about that monk," father said anxiously. "It's obviously a touchy subject." At last Earl Roland appeared. Prior Anthony was with him. The knights and squires mounted up. Ralph kissed his parents and swung himself into the saddle. Griff danced sideways, eager to be off. The motion made Ralph's broken nose hurt like fire. He gritted his teeth. There was nothing he could do but endure it. Roland went up to his horse, Victory, a black stallion with a white patch over one eye. He did not mount, but took the bridle and began to walk, still in conversation with the prior. William called out, "Sir Stephen Wagley and Ralph Fitzgerald, ride ahead and clear the bridge." Ralph and Stephen rode across the cathedral green. The grass was trampled and the ground muddy from the Fleece Fair. A few stalls were still doing business, but most were closing and many had already gone. They passed out through the priory gates. On the main street, Ralph saw the boy who had given him a broken nose. Wulfric, his name was, and he came from Stephen's village of Wigley. The left side of his face was bruised and swollen where Ralph had repeatedly punched him. Wulfric was outside the Bell Inn with his father, mother, and brother. They appeared to be about to leave. "You'd better hope you never meet me again," Ralph thought. He tried to think of some insult to shout, but he was distracted by the sound of a crowd. As he and Stephen rode down the main street, their horses stepping adroitly through the mud, they saw ahead of them a mob of people. Halfway down the hill, they were forced to stop. The street was jammed by hundreds of men, women, and children shouting, laughing, and jostling for space. They all had their backs to Ralph. He looked over their heads. At the front of this unruly procession was a cart drawn by an ox. Tied to the back of the cart was a half-naked woman. Ralph had seen this kind of thing before. To be whipped through the town was a common punishment. The woman wore only a skirt of rough wool secured at the waist by a cord. Her face, when he could see it, was begrimed, and her hair was filthy, so that at first he thought she was old. Then he saw her breasts and realized she was only in her 20s. Her hands were bound together and attached by the same rope to the back end of the cart. She stumbled along behind it, sometimes falling and being dragged, writhing through the mud, until she managed to get back on her feet. The town constable followed, vigorously lashing her bare back with a bullwhip, a strip of leather at the end of a stick. The crowd, led by a knot of young men, were taunting the woman, shouting insults, laughing and throwing mud and rubbish. She delighted them by responding, screaming imprecations and spitting at anyone who got near her. Ralph and Stephen urged their horses into the crowd. Ralph raised his voice. "Clear the way!" he shouted at the top of his voice. "Make way for the Earl!" Stephen did the same. No one took any notice. To the south of the priory, the ground sloped steeply down to the river. The bank on that side was rocky, unsuitable for loading barges and rafts, so all the wharves were on the more accessible south side, in the suburb of Newtown. The quiet north side bloomed at this time of year with shrubbery and wild flowers. Merthyn and Carys sat on a low bluff overlooking the water. The river was swollen with rain. It moved faster than it used to, Merthyn noticed, and he could see why. The channel was narrower than formerly. That was because of the development of the riverside. When he was a child, most of the south bank had been a wide, muddy beach with a swampy field beyond. The river then had flowed at a stately pace, and as a boy he had floated on his back from one side to the other. But the new wharves, protected from flooding by stone walls, squeezed the same quantity of water into a smaller funnel, through which it hurried, as if eager to get past the bridge. Beyond the bridge, the river widened and slowed around Leper Island. "I've done something terrible," Merthyn said to Carys. Unfortunately, she looked particularly lovely today. She wore a dark red linen dress, and her skin seemed to glow with vitality. She had been angry at the trial of Crazy Nell, but now she just seemed worried, and that gave her a vulnerable look that tugged at Merthyn's heart. She must have noticed how he had been unable to meet her eye all week, but what he had to tell her was probably worse than anything she had imagined. He had spoken to no one about this since the row with Griselda, Elfric, and Alice. No one even knew that his door had been destroyed. He was longing to unburden himself, but he had held back. He did not want to talk to his parents. His mother would be judgmental, and his father would just tell him to be a man. He might have talked to Ralph, but there had been a coolness between them since the fight with Wulfric. Merthyn thought Ralph had behaved like a bully, and Ralph knew it. He dreaded telling Carys the truth. For a moment he asked himself why. It was not that he was afraid of what she would do. She might be scornful. She was good at that. But she could not say anything worse than the things he said to himself constantly. What he truly feared, he realized, was hurting her. He could bear her anger. It was her pain he could not face. She said, "Do you still love me?" He was not expecting the question, but he answered without hesitation, "Yes." "And I love you. Anything else is just a problem we can solve together." He wished she were right. He wished it so badly that tears came to his eyes. He looked away so that she would not see. A mob of people was moving onto the bridge, following a slow-moving cart. and he realized this must be Crazy Nell being whipped through the town on her way to Gallows Cross in Newtown. The bridge was already crowded with departing stallholders and their carts, and the traffic was almost at a standstill.
"What's the matter?" Caris said. "Are you crying?"
"I lay with Griselda," Merthyn said abruptly. Caris's mouth dropped open.
"Griselda," she said unbelievingly. "I'm so ashamed. I thought it must be Elizabeth Clark.
She's too proud to offer herself." Caris's reaction to that surprised him.
"Oh, so you would have done it with her, too, if she'd suggested it."
"That's not what I meant."
"Griselda! Dear St. Mary, I thought I was worth more than that."
"You are."
"Lupa,"
she said, using the Latin word for a whore. "I don't even like her. I hated it."
"Is that supposed to make me feel better? Are you saying you wouldn't be so sorry if you'd enjoyed it?"
"No!" Merthyn was dismayed. Caris seemed determined to misinterpret everything he said.
"Whatever got into you?" "She was crying." "Oh, for God's sake! Do you do that to every girl you see crying?"
"Of course not.
I was just trying to explain to you how it happened, even though I really didn't want it to."
Her scorn got worse with everything he said.
"Don't talk rubbish," she said. "If you hadn't wanted it to happen, it wouldn't have."
"Listen to me, please," he said frustratedly. "She asked me, and I said no. Then she cried, and I put my arm around her to comfort her. Then, oh, spare me the sickening details. I don't want to know."
He began to feel resentful. He knew he had done wrong, and he expected her to be angry, but her contempt stung.
"All right," he said, and he shut up.
But silence was not what she wanted. She stared at him in dissatisfaction, then said, "What else?" He shrugged. "What's the point in my speaking? You just pour scorn on everything I say."
"I don't want to listen to pathetic excuses, but there's something you haven't told me. I can feel it."
He sighed.
"She's pregnant."
Caris's reaction surprised him again. All the anger left her. Her face, until now taut with indignation, seemed to collapse. Only sadness remained.
"A baby," she said. "Griselda is going to have your baby."
"It may not happen," he said. "Sometimes..."
Caris shook her head.
"Griselda is a healthy girl, well fed. There's no reason she should miscarry."
"Not that I'd wish it," he said,
though he was not quite sure that was true.
"But what will you do?" she said. "It will be your child.
You will love it, even if you hate its mother."
"I've got to marry her."
Caris gasped.
"Marry? But that would be forever."
"I fathered a child, so I should take care of it.
But to spend your whole life with Griselda?"
"I know.
You don't have to," she said decisively.
"Think, Elizabeth Clark's father didn't marry her mother.
He was a bishop. There's Maud Roberts in Slaughterhouse Lane. She has 3 children, and everyone knows the father is Edward Butcher.
He's already married and has 4 other children with his wife." "I'm saying they don't always force people to marry. You could just carry on as you are."
"No, I couldn't. Elfric would throw me out."
She looked thoughtful. "So, you've already talked to Elfric?"
"Talked." Merthyn touched his bruised cheek. "I thought he was going to kill me.
And his wife, my sister, she screamed at me."
"So she knows?"
"Yes.
She said I have to marry Griselda. She never wanted me to be with you anyway. I don't know why."
Caris muttered, "She wanted you for herself." That was news to Merthyn. It seemed unlikely that the haughty Alice would be attracted to a lowly apprentice.
I never saw any sign of that.
Only because you never looked at her. That's what made her so cross. She married Elfric in frustration. You broke my sister's heart, and now you're breaking mine.
Merthyn looked away. He barely recognized this picture of himself as a heartbreaker. How had things gone so wrong?
Caris went quiet.
Merthyn stared moodily along the river to the bridge.
The crowd had come to a standstill, he saw. A heavy cart loaded with woolsacks was stuck at the southern end, probably with a broken wheel. The cart pulling Nell had stopped, unable to pass. The crowd was swarming around both carts, and some people had climbed onto the woolsacks for a better view. Earl Roland was also trying to leave. He was at the town end of the bridge, on horseback, with his entourage, but even they were having trouble getting the citizens to give way. Merthyn spotted his brother Ralph on his horse, chestnut-coloured, with a black mane and tail. Prior Anthony, who had evidently come to see the Earl off, stood wringing his hands with anxiety while Roland's men forced their horses into the mob, trying in vain to clear a passage. Merthyn's intuition rang an alarm. Something was badly wrong, he felt sure, though at first he did not know what. He looked more closely at the bridge. He had noticed on Monday that the massive oak beams stretching from one piling to another across the length of the bridge were showing cracks on the upstream side, and that the beams had been strengthened with iron braces nailed across the cracks. Merthyn had not been involved in this job, which was why he had not previously looked hard at the work. On Monday he had wondered why the beams were cracking. The weakness was not halfway between the uprights, as you would have expected if the timbers had simply deteriorated over time. Rather, the cracks were near the central pier, where the strain should have been less. He had not thought about it since Monday. There was too much else on his mind. But now an explanation occurred to him. It was almost as if that central pier was not supporting the beams, but dragging them down. That would mean that something had undermined the foundation beneath the pier, and as soon as that thought occurred to him, he realized how it could have happened. It must be the faster flow of the river, scouring the riverbed from under the pier. He remembered walking barefoot on a sandy beach as a child, and noticing that when he stood at the sea's edge, letting the water wash over his feet, the outgoing waves would suck the sand from under his toes. That kind of phenomenon had always fascinated him. If he was right, the central pier, with nothing underneath to support it, was now hanging from the bridge, hence the cracks. Elfric's iron braces had not helped. In fact, they might have worsened the problem by making it impossible for the bridge to settle slowly into a new, stable position. Merthyn guessed that the other pier of the pair, on the farther downstream side of the bridge, was still grounded. The current surely spent most of its force on the upstream pier, and attacked the second of the pair with reduced violence. Only one pier was affected, and it seemed that the rest of the structure was knitted together strongly enough for the entire bridge to stay upright, as long as it was not subjected to extraordinary strain. But the cracks seemed wider today than on Monday, and it was not difficult to guess why. Hundreds of people were on the bridge, a much greater load than it normally took, and there was a heavily laden wool cart with 20 or 30 people sitting on the sacks of wool to add to the burden. Fear gripped Merthyn's heart. He did not think the bridge could withstand that level of strain for long. He was vaguely aware that Caris was speaking, but her meaning did not penetrate his thoughts until she raised her voice and said, "You're not even listening."
"There's going to be a terrible accident," he said.
"What do you mean?"
"We have to get everyone off the bridge."
"Are you mad? They're all tormenting Crazy Nell. Even Earl Roland can't get them to move. They're not going to listen to you."
"I think it could collapse."
"Oh, look," said Caris, pointing. "Can you see someone running along the road from the forest, approaching the south end of the bridge?"
Merthyn wondered what that had to do with anything, but he followed her pointing finger.
Sure enough, he saw the figure of a young woman running, her hair flying. Karis said, "It looks like Gwenda." Behind her, in hot pursuit, was a man in a yellow tunic. Gwenda was more tired than she had ever been in her life. She knew that the fastest way to cover a long distance was to run 20 paces, then walk 20 paces. She had started to do that half a day ago, when she spotted Sim Chapman a mile behind her. For a while she lost sight of him, but when once again the road provided her with a long rearward view, she saw that he, too, was walking and running alternately. As mile succeeded mile and hour followed hour, he gained on her. By mid-morning she had known that at this rate he would catch her before she reached Kingsbridge. In desperation, she had taken to the forest, but she could not stray far from the road for fear of losing her way. Eventually, she heard running steps and heavy breathing, and peered through the undergrowth to see Sim go by on the road. She realized that as soon as he came to a long, clear stretch, he would guess what she had done. Sure enough, some time later she saw him come back. She had pressed on through the forest, stopping every few minutes to stand in silence and listen. For a long time she had evaded him, and she knew he would have to search the woods on both sides of the road to make sure she was not in hiding. But her progress was also slow, for she had to fight her way through the summer undergrowth and keep checking that she had not strayed too far from the road. When she heard the sound of a distant crowd, she knew she could not be far from the city, and she thought she was going to escape after all. She made her way to the road and cautiously looked out from a bush. The way was clear in both directions, and, a quarter of a mile to the north, she could see the tower of the cathedral. She was almost there. She heard a familiar bark, and her dog, Skip, emerged from the bushes at the side of the road. She bent to pat him, and he wagged joyfully, licking her hands. Tears came to her eyes. Sim was not in sight, so she risked the open road. She wearily resumed her 20 paces of running and 20 of walking, now with Skip trotting happily beside her, thinking this was a new game. Each time she switched, she looked back over her shoulder. The third time she did so, she saw Sim. He was only a couple of 100 yards behind. Despair washed over her like a tidal wave. She wanted to lie down and die. But she was in the suburbs now, and the bridge was only a quarter of a mile away. She forced herself to keep going. She tried to sprint, but her legs refused to obey orders. A staggering jog was the best she could manage. Her feet hurt. Looking down, she saw blood seeping through the holes in her tattered shoes. As she turned the corner at Gallows Cross, she saw a huge crowd on the bridge ahead of her. They were all looking at something, and no one noticed her running for her life, with Sim Chapman close behind. She had no weapons other than her eating knife, which would just about cut through a baked hare, but would hardly disable a man. She wished with all her heart that she had had the nerve to pull Alwyn's long dagger out of his head and bring it away with her. Now she was virtually defenseless. She had a row of small houses on one side of her, the suburban homes of people too poor to live in the city, and on the other side, a pasture called Lover's Field, owned by the Priory. Sim was so close behind her that she could hear his breathing, harsh and ragged like her own. Terror gave her a last burst of energy. Skip barked, but there was more fear than defiance in his note. He had not forgotten the stone that hit him on the nose. The approach to the bridge was a swamp of sticky mud, churned up by boots, hooves, and cartwheels. Gwenda waded through it, desperately hoping that the heavier Sim would be hampered even more than she. At last she reached the bridge. She pushed into the crowd, which was less dense at this end. They were all looking the other way, where a heavy cart loaded with wool was blocking the passage of an ox cart. She had to get to Karis's house, almost in sight now on the main street. "Let me through!" she screamed, fighting her way forward. Only one person seemed to hear her. A head turned to look, and she saw the face of her brother Philemon. His mouth dropped open in alarm, and he tried to move towards her, but the crowd resisted him as it resisted her. Gwenda tried to push past the team of oxen drawing the wool cart, but an ox tossed its massive head and knocked her sideways. She lost her footing, and, at that moment, a big hand grasped her arm in a powerful grip, and she knew she was recaptured.
"I've got you, you bitch!" Sim gasped.
He pulled her to him and slapped her across the face as hard as he could. She had no strength left to resist him. Skip snapped ineffectually at his heels.
"You won't get away from me again," he said.
Despair engulfed her. It had all been for nothing.